This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
If you love the Intelligent Scribe podcast, you can support the show and help us do what we do by hitting subscribe via Apple Podcasts. And in return, you'll get bonus content, ad-free listening, and early episodes too.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm Connor Boyle. Coming up on the podcast, John Sweeney, the investigative journalist and writer, discusses his new book, Killer in the Kremlin. As a journalist, John Sweeney is never far from the most perilous and murky stories of our times. His latest book is a study of Vladimir Putin, his rise and his destructive tyranny that has powered wars in locations such as Chechnya, Georgia, Syria, and of course today in Ukraine. Our host today is Carl Miller, Research Director of the Center for the Analysis of Social Media at Demos. Here's Carl with more.
Hi there, everyone, and welcome. I'm joined, of course, by John Sweeney, award-winning writer and reporter. He spent much of 2022 in Ukraine. I'm sure so many of you have been following, as I have, all of the reporting that he's been doing there. He worked as an investigative journalist for BBC Newsnight and Panorama for 17 years and is the author of 12 books, including the best-selling novel set in the war in Burma, Elephant Moon. And, of course, we're talking about his new book today, Killer in the Kremlin. John, very warm welcome. Thanks so much for coming today.
Cheers, Carl. It's a pleasure. My only caveat with this whole thing is I'm a bit thick, so I think for me it should be called Intelligence Halved.
Well, welcome to this Intelligence Halved event with John Sweeney, proceeding otherwise as planned. John, let's begin about the book. I wanted to begin in a place where I think your reporting is never shirked from, and the book certainly doesn't. The kind of horrors of war. It begins with the kind of horrors that you've seen. There's a line where you just say war crime after war crime after war crime. Could you just take us through some of the things you've seen in 2022 in Ukraine?
So it starts with this kind of column of heavy metal going towards Ukraine. And the Russians are saying, the Kremlin is saying, we're not going to invade, it's just exercise. And it's strange and creepy. But I feel passionately that the West has kept on backing down from Putin. Putin trades in violence. And the West response is to say, well, let's see if we can live with this guy. Can we do a deal? Can we, if we back down, then it'll go away. And this happens on repeat. And I first called Vladimir Putin a war criminal when I saw evidence of Russian army war crimes in Chechnya 22 years ago. So for me, this is very, very personal. And I didn't want to run away. And that's why I flew to Kyiv. I actually flew to Kyiv on Valentine's Day. I've had some rough Valentine's days in my life, and that was like, this was the worst. Anyway, so the war starts. I can remember the evening of the war, I was invited to a party with supermodels. And when I got there, there were no supermodels. Of course there were. There were just journalists sort of gorging themselves on alcohol and chunks of cheese and saveloy. And we watched Joe Biden saying they've made the decision they're going to invade. And it was so bleak, this party, that I left and found a bar and I found some Ukrainians. And I said, Biden said it's going to happen. No, it's not going to happen. And I could just, it felt like being inside W.H. Auden's poem, September the 1st, 1939. It felt like being inside the gloom of George Orwell when he wrote about the midnight of the century, the Nazi Soviet pact. It felt like that. Then day two, I get arrested as a Russian spy. I'm wearing this. By the way, this costs, I'm actually a kind of lapsed Catholic of Irish Catholic stock. So actually I just bought it on a skiing holiday for €3. But what happened was it was cold and I'm bald. So I put it on my head. And wearing it. I was filming everything for my Twitter stuff because I have Patreons and they want to see films, diaries. And I filmed the Ukrainian army because before it was fine, but suddenly the war had started and it changed. On day two, I was arrested as a Russian spy. Do I look like a Russian spy? Can't never argue with a man with a loaded machine gun. But anyway, the guy who arrested me is called Vlad Demchenko, and we've become great friends since. If you're on Twitter, follow him. He's Broken Pixel UA. He's done it for Ukraine, and he's a really seriously funny warrior poet. He's great, and he's a great friend of mine. And so I did a video that very night in which I said, rough old day. I took a drink like I'm doing right now. Thank God for alcohol. I explained I'd been arrested as a Russian spy. They looked me over. They sent me to the SBU headquarters, Ukrainian intelligence, to check me out. At that particular moment, number one target is Zelensky's presidency. Number two is the SBU headquarters. And I'm there for an hour while they kind of like faff about checking me out. And I kind of wanted to say to them, I say, chaps, could you kind of hurry this up a bit? Because I don't want to be fried tonight. Okay. But you can never argue with military bureaucracy. It's just like a parking ticket with men with machine guns. You know, you've just got to say. I mean,
we joke now, but you must have genuinely thought that it was, you know, a cruise missile could have landed on your head at any point.
It could, yeah, but it's worse if you're bald, because but at the same time, I'm kind of used to the risk, and there's a little part of me which is both insane and reckless, but also calculated, and I suspected that Putin didn't want to smash Kyiv up because he wanted it to fall like a plum into his hand, and therefore it was a runnable risk. And I did a video that very night which said, I think, actually, weird, you know, electricity is still on, the internet is still on, and I'm still here, although I've been arrested as a Russian spy. But I think the person who's in trouble is not Zelensky, it's not even me, it's Vladimir Putin, because he's not sold this war to his people. And I said that on day two, and I got a million views. So that was my thing. But then, you know, the war happened. I was there on my own. I wasn't working for an organization. I started up on Patreon, and it really worked. But I didn't have a flak jacket or a helmet because part of me didn't think the war would happen. And eventually I got both. And then when the Russian army left, I went to Bucha on very early April. And we got there where the dead were still left in people's gardens. And we found two Ukrainian civilians. One had been shot in the back of the head and the other in the forehead, a huge hole there. And they're both war crimes, bang, bang. And I think that the guy who'd been shot in the face was the most obscene thing I've ever seen, or one of the most obscene things. And then we went a day or two later to Borodanka. And what happened there was, this was a town on the road to Kyiv, north of Bucha. And the Russian Air Force had punched a missile into an apartment block. And they'd killed 40 people stone dead in that second. And everything in the apartments had blasted onto this children's playground. So you picked up bits of other people's lives. I love you. Can you order some fresh milk? Here's my diploma for speaking English well. This kind of stuff. But on the way there, Carl, I mean, we passed car after car after car, which had got Dzieci, Russian for children, scribbles in, you know, in paints on the cars that had been shot up. So imagine the Russians attack Essex, and everybody who lives in Southend-on-Sea is on the run, and they put kids in paint on their cars, and they're shot up on the A13. That's what it felt like. And then, you know, the numbers come out. In Bucha, there was a mass grave. There was a kind of a claw, somebody's hand, blue, gray, green, plastic bags. Dozens and dozens of bodies. Now, in war, most of the time, people died by artillery, shrapnel. I've got a little, let me show you This is what I picked up from the Kyiv TV tower early on. Can you see? So what happens is when a missile comes in, it smashes and explodes, and then you get stuff like this scatters. It's boiling hot. It's moving at 900 miles an hour. And when it lands, by the way, it tinkles in a slightly weird sound. But this stuff, if it hits you, you're dead. And there was something pitiless about this. But what was strange about what happened in Bucha is that normally in war, something like 7 out of 10 people are killed by shrapnel. In Bucha, 7 out of 10 people were killed by bullets. That's execution. And the Kadyrovites, these are these Chechen friends who detest Ramzan Kadyrov, who's a kind of Chechen quisling. They say there's no question in their mind that he's a quisling. His people, the Kadyrovites, they're cold-blooded killers. And there's a problem in that with my Ukrainian friends. They say there's an existentialist problem with Russia itself. And I like to challenge that, and I like to say, no, that's not true. Russia's better than that. But at the same time, you see this stuff, and it makes me doubt my own argument. It's very, very difficult.
In fact, actually, John, it was exactly this point, actually, that tract, that specific argument I was going to read to you next. So it's towards the end of the book, but to me it was kind of giving your rationale for writing it. It says, nearly all my Ukrainian friends whom I adore believe there is something preternaturally wrong with Russia and the Russian soul, that Putin is just one monster among many from the swamp to the east. With love and respect, I don't agree with them. This is Vladimir Putin's war.
Yes. By the way, I've argued that inside the camp of the Ukrainian Volunteer Corps, surrounded, and Vlad invited me, the guys, and so everybody's like, but it's a democracy and it's a democratic army. And what I said was that there are, and as Zelensky gave a press conference, by the way, super cool. Where do you hold a press conference if you're a number one target of Russian missiles? You hold it in the tube station, and you hold it in the deepest tube station in the whole of Kyiv. So imagine, like, I think it, whatever it is, Hampstead. So imagine, like,
and then, one of the most remarkable press conferences, surely, in the history of the 21st century.
It was, well, and the 20. I mean, I've been around for a very. I've been a reporter for 40 years plus, and the only other thing which touched it for drama was going to performance. Produced by Susan Sontag, Waiting for Godot in Sarajevo, in Serbo-Croat Bosnian, in Sarajevo, while we're being shelled. And that's the best play I've ever been to. Even though I didn't understand a word, you understood everything. And then the press conference. At the press conference, I asked Zelensky, remember, by the way, I'm working for the Jewish Chronicle. And when the Jewish Chronicle found me up, they say, everybody else has fucked off. Can you write for us? I said, I'm not Jewish. I'm lapsed Catholic and I'm a bad Catholic. I'm not even, you know, anyway. And they said, we don't care. There's no one else. So, and every time I wrote for the Jewish Chronicle, I put in a Muslim. There was a fighting imam and then there was a fighting Chechens, just for a bit of balance. Every word went in. It was lovely. But anyway, John Sweeney, Jewish Chronicle, which sounds absurd, but anyway, never mind. And President Zelensky, what's your message to the Russian opposition? The kids in Moscow and St. Petersburg who are protesting against the war and get their teeth kicked in by the police. This guy, there was lots of people, but one of them was a man who brought a copy of War and Peace to the Kyiv Monument in Red Square, and he was arrested. And Alexei Navalny. And Zelensky, who's he's kind of like Rowan Atkinson in terms of he's a tremendous comedic actor like Rowan Atkinson. And then suddenly he's become like Churchill, and his transformation is extraordinary and beautiful. But he dodges the Navalny bullet cleverly, and he says, these people are very brave, and we're grateful to them. Words are as powerful as nuclear bombs. So I think Zelensky gets it. Remember, Zelensky before the war was a moderate, was somebody who wanted to kind of live with Vladimir Putin and actually sent a message, this isn't going to happen, so consistently that it could almost be foolish. So since the war has started, he's behaved so bravely that I don't care about his mistakes before the war, and that goes to nearly all the Ukrainians. But I do hope, if we're thinking about Russia after Putin, that what they have to do is find somebody like Willy Brandt, who has the moral courage, who went to the Warsaw Ghetto and he knelt and he reflected Germany's shame for what Germany did during the Second World War. And the Russians need to find a Willy Brandt and they need to say sorry and they need to help Ukraine stick itself back together again. And we shouldn't ever reduce sanctions and our pressure on Russia until Russia chooses that kind of future. But for the moment, it is locked in some weird Eurasianist, neo-Stalinist, neo-fascist past, which is hideous beyond belief.
Well, John, let's focus on Putin, because I guess there are these two threads, aren't there, at least to my reading throughout your book. You know, firstly, trying to understand what Putin is like as a man and how he sees the world and why he's turned out the way that he has and why he makes the decision that he has. But then also why we have to care so much about Putin as a man, you know, and this kind of the second tragedy that he's kind of been thrown into a position of such power and influence over all of our lives, seeming so far away. So let's deal with both of those. There's the kind of chronological arc, I guess, you know, a kind of early childhood, kind of athletic scholarship at university, early KGB postings. What of that is it strikes you as being the kind of first or most important kind of early punctuation point or kind of early formative experience for Putin? Is it that, you know, I found this very striking that he hadn't himself personally experienced any of the main reasons why the Soviet Union collapsed.
Yes.
That seemed to me an extremely important part of his formation.
So Putin's on record as saying that the falling apart of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical tragedy of the 20th century. Come on. Does it really, really match the First World War, which caused the Second World War, which caused the Holocaust? Those three are less tragic than the fall of the Soviet Union, which started out essentially as a Stalinist, sort of a Stalinist fascist thing, which kind of slowly degenerated into a kind of alcoholic senility under Brezhnev and then Andropov was sober, but nevertheless, it was a kind of dreadful stuff. Now, what happened was the three things that killed the Soviet Union: Putin was absent without leave, or wasn't there. The three things that killed the Soviet Union: one was the war in Afghanistan. Putin didn't go. Number two was Chernobyl. Putin didn't go. And number three was the failure of the Soviet economy to keep pace with Western growth, economic growth, which is a good thing, which means that we've lifted hundreds of millions and now billions of people out of poverty through a regulated free market. And alongside that, through democracy and the rule of law, which you need absolutely to police the free market. Now, obviously, we make mistakes, but Putin never understood why the country he loved killed itself. We didn't kill it, it killed itself. So he never got that. What he got was a kind of deep romantic attachment to the Soviet Union, which essentially had, you know, communist rhetoric, but you strip that aside, from pretty early on, from about 1925 onwards, when Stalin gets hold of the machinery, it becomes, I think, more, to understand it better, it becomes a kind of, it becomes Russian nationalism, Russian fascism, Russian imperialism with a shiny red paint job. But it's still part of that. Although Stalin was originally Georgian, he became a kind of Russian nationalist turbocharged. And that was the real dominant thing. And the thing that's holding it together is the secret police. To begin with, it's called the Cheka. Lots of alphabets, the three letters they call it, the GPU, the OGPU, the NKVD, KGB, best way of understanding it. And Putin starts life as a kind of gangster's, I'm going to say gangster's mole deliberately to piss him off. But he was there's a friend of mine, Jim Fallon, who's professor of psychiatry, University of California. He makes a study of world leaders who end up like Putin. And he says the common thing, Pol Pot's an exception. He doesn't properly understand why. But virtually everybody else, Hitler, Stalin, Mao, Putin, have been in some way sexually abused or abandoned by their parents or mother at a very early age. And he believes this is the case with Putin. I don't have a clear grip on exactly what happened, but that's what he believes. So Putin has got no friends, and then he joins this mixed martial arts group, which is a mixture of karate and the Russian, it's a Soviet thing called Sambo. Mixed martial arts is the best way of describing it. And the guy who runs it is a mafia bloke called Uvyatsov. I mispronounce it, I'm sure. And this guy on his grave, I am dead, but the mafia is immortal. So the number one thing for Putin is gangsterism. Gangster gets him into university on an athletic scholarship, and then he joins the KGB. And then the kind of what happens is the gangsters and the KGB, they come together, and what you have is a gangsterization of the secret police, or the secret policeization of the gangsters. And so what you've got in Russia under Putin is a hybrid state of an intelligence service / the secret police / the Gambino crime family. I mean, honestly, you can read my book, but the other thing you should always read or reread is Bertolt Brecht's The Irresistible Rise of Arturo Uhy to kind of understand this stuff. And what drives me nuts, Carl, is when people like Scholz, possibly down the track, Rishi Sunak, if he becomes prime minister, we're saying, well, let's see if we can do a deal. And it's like doing a deal with Hitler or the Gambinos or Al Capone. You can't do a deal with these people. You've just got to stop them.
I mean, I think it's worth noting for the audience at this point that John, kind of the issues you're raising now, I'm sure ones we're going to touch on, journalists have been literally killed for investigating these exact topics, haven't they? You know, as well as dissidents, you know, Alex Politskaya and Boris Nemtsov and Boris Berezovsky, many of whom you knew or had met, you know, all of them, a long line of people that have now died in mysterious circumstances. Has this always been the way that Putin has dealt with external criticism or kind of, I guess, investigatory pressure?
Yes. So actually, the reporter from Germany asked me, how many people do you think he's killed? And I actually haven't put it in this bit, but I'll for the next edition, I'll run through some numbers. So what happens very early on is in September 99, there's the Moscow apartment bombs. Basically, Putin's got, he's an insipid secret policeman, a rather creepy one, and his poll ratings are 2%. Yeltsin has given him, basically, he's made him his heir apparent, but people are saying, who the fuck are you? You know, you're nobody. And then Chechen terrorists blow up Moscow. 300 people are killed in Moscow and some cities in southern Russia. Putin blames Chechen terrorists and said, we're going to wipe them out on the bog. We're going to get them. And this tough talking, it makes him enormously popular overnight. And he kind of captures the spirit of Russian ethno-nationalism and turbocharges it through this hate speech against the Chechen terrorist enemy. And the evidence is overwhelming, I said out in my book, that the Moscow apartment bombs was a black operation by the KGB. No question. And then everybody who starts asking questions with the same kind of I don't give a fuck that I have gets poisoned or gets shot. In particular, there's a guy who I never met, but I love him from beyond the grave. There's a guy called Yoro Shaka Chicken. He was investigating the Moscow apartment bombs. He drinks tea. His hair starts to fall out. His skin starts to flake. And his girlfriend, he dies. And his girlfriend visits him in the morgue. And she can't find him. But there's an old grandma who looks like her grandma. And she feels sorrow for this old lady who looks like her grandma. And she goes to the morgue guy and says, I can't find Yuri. He's not here. And the morgue guy says, over there. And it was the grandma, i.e. that Yuri Shaka Chicken's lover couldn't identify him because the poison had changed him completely and utterly, so he was unrecognizable to his own lover. My friend, Professor Norman Dombey, who's with Marina Litvinenko's expert witness at the long-delayed inquiry into the poisoning of Litvinenko, is a kind of Sherlock Holmes. Dombey is super clever. To tease him, I'm always provocative. I said, do you know anything about theoretical physics? A little bit. Do you pass an exam? So I passed a few. Where do you get a degree? Oxford. They give them away there. And he goes, and irritable. He goes, and I did my doctorate at Caltech, where my supervisor was Murray Gell-Mann, who won the Nobel Prize for inventing the quark. So that shut me up. And then, by the way, Norman opened a can of Spitfire beer. Like it was 12:30, drinking before I was. Terrible. But Norman, who's Sherlock Holmes, he can tell you the polonium-210 that killed Litvinenko was cooked up, was baked in the Sarov nuclear reactor in the city of Avangard. I might have got that, but all these names sound like something out of The Lord of the Rings. You know, like, but Norman's on it, completely on it. His working hypothesis is the Russian secret state wouldn't have used polonium-210 first on Litvinenko without trying it out on others here. And so he believes that Shaka Chicken was poisoned with 210, polonium-210, as with a Russian gangster who knew the dirt about Putin, Roman Sepov, as was a Chechen warrior called Lucha Ismailov, if memory serves. And those three were the guinea pigs before trying it out on Litvinenko. But the significance of all of this is that after Litvinenko, the British government kicked out four diplomats who were spies. Like, all that happens is that Putin gets the spy factory in Moscow to print out four more diplomatic passports. So this is a game where we are losing, and Litvinenko was a British citizen at this point, and there was a lot of polonium littered across London. We're losing people, our people, and Putin's playing with Monopoly Bunny. And so what you get, as well as war crime after war crime after war crime, I'll repeat, we're not standing up to him. And Scholz is not standing up to him. And I'm worried about Rishi Sunak if he gets it. I'm worried about the West revolved to stand up to this serial killer.
If you'd like to support us in providing a home for passionate debate, deep discussion, and answering the big questions that really matter, do consider becoming an Intelligence Squared Premium Podcast subscriber today. For just a small amount each month, you won't just be directly helping us continue to do what we do. You'll also be getting exclusive episodes each month, ad-free listening, and early access too. Currently available via Apple Podcasts. You just need to hit the subscribe button. And if you're not an Apple user, don't worry, we're working on something for you too. Thanks for being a listener, supporting Intelligence Squared, and you're just one click away from getting some exclusive extras too. The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code squared, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code squared to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV.
John, earlier you said that, you know, you, like other war correspondents, have this kind of, you know, on the one side, a kind of risk-taking kind of appetite, but on another, a kind of calculation and a kind of ability to try and manage risks. How have you managed over your career to manage the risk of reporting on Putin? I mean, it seems to me, I mean, the book you've written, I mean, explicitly it says at parts two, to piss him off. I mean, you doorstepped him in Russia, face to face. How have you tried to, especially given this kind of long phalanx of illustrious colleagues of yours who have literally died as a result of trying to report, how have you managed to kind of keep yourself safe or try and navigate around the threats that are inherent in this whole area?
So you're most dangerous if you're Russian or speak Russian completely fluently, and I don't. So that I'm trading in English or I'm dealing with English. So although I'm one of the more, I would say I'm in the top 10 of the most annoying journalists in the English language, I'm not in the Russian language. And at the moment, my book hasn't been translated into Russian. I would like that to happen. But that's number one. So that lowers the risk. Secondly, I'm based in London. And so what happened was that I would go over there, do a film for Panorama or Newsnight, but actually always Panorama, and then come back to London, then the film would go out. So that the risk is mitigated. You know, listen, I pour my own drinks, I pour my own tea.
All right, we're about to go to the audience, and I can already see the questions pouring in. And do get writing, everyone, if you have any more. But before we do, John, let's just kind of flash forward for a second just to the state now. And I guess the two big questions that everyone is asking, number one, is Putin well? I know you there's part of the book we talk about like roid rage and kind of Putin's actual state of health. And secondly, is he still in control? I know you use this kind of idea of kind of Wizard of Oz, that the kind of maybe some of the kind of marionette strings have been taken away from him since the invasion. The Kremlin doesn't tolerate a loser. What do you think right now is the kind of state of play, both in terms of Putin's health and whether he still is really calling the shots?
So in terms of the health, it's very difficult to get a proper fix on it. There's a simple reason for that. There's all the people who were good in Russia who to do my kind of job, they've either been poisoned or shot or had to flee or they're in jail. So when people say, well, why don't you know? Well, because everybody who tries to find out gets killed or has to go or gets locked up. But when I met him in 2014, I doorstepped him after the shooting down of MH17. His face, he had Botox, so it was weird and plasticky, but the structure of his face was lean. He looked like a space alien or a weasel. Now he looks like a hamster. His cheeks stuffed with straw. And my friend, Ashley Grossman, I said, well, you bet a fiver that he's been overdoing it on the steroids, some kind of steroid abuse. And Ashley goes, no, 50 quid. 50 quid on some kind of cancer of the lymphatic system. That's Ashley's take. And Ashley's a very, very, you know, he's professor of neuroendocrinology at Oxford. He really is intelligence cubed. Well, I'm intelligence half. So he thinks that, however, I've forgotten the name of the guy who runs Britain's military these days. He's the first Sea Lord or whatever. They said, well, the way we look at it is that we think Putin's in there for the long game. There's consistency. So obviously British, they're not buying Putin's ill. All I know is that when I met him, he looked like a weasel and now he looks like a hamster. And my friend Ashley Grossman, professor of medicine at Oxford, thinks that indicates steroid abuse. There's a bit of example from history. JFK had Addison's disease and you treated it with steroids. It was early days of steroid treatment and they overdosed him. He looked like a hamster and he was erratic. And he helped generate the Bay of Pigs crisis. So you can actually think of like two great crises, the one now and the Bay of Pigs, the Cuban Missiles crisis, could both be roid rage. We'll see. I think Putin's much weaker than everybody thinks he is. For example, he still doesn't call it a war. It's a special military operation. He's not calling for universal conscription because he's afraid to call kids who live in Moscow and St. Petersburg because their mums and dads will hit the street. Navalny is still alive. Why? Navalny is incredibly rude about Putin. Why is Navalny still alive? Because Putin is afraid to have him killed, because if he has him killed, people will go out in the streets to protest. So Putin's weaker, and I think his control is weaker too.
Well, actually, that nicely brings us on to a number of these questions, which I'll just kind of synopsize or précis. John, what's the end game? How does Putin leave power?
Well, I don't want to give the ending of my book. Well, I'll give the ending away. The idea, so it's possible that a general comes back from the army, accused of cowardice or whatever, and just pops in with his revolver. That's always a possibility, because the Russian generals are risking, and there are three problems with the Russian army. Number one is morale. They don't have a good reason to fight the war. Ukrainians are defending their homes. Number two, the Russian logistics are dreadful, and the recent arrival of the American long-range HIMARS rocket artillery systems is killing all the Russian ammo dumps. Got a major problem with logistics. Number three, bad leadership. Bad in the sense of incompetent, bad in the sense of evil. Putin all the way down. So I think the army's in trouble. The Russian army's in trouble. And this autumn, through the winter into the spring, so long as the West stands by our Ukrainian heroic friends, then I think the Russian army's in trouble. And if they're in trouble, then Putin's in trouble too. Where it becomes scary is that he, you know, the talk of nuclear escalation will go up, and we've got to see through his bluff. That's my take. And I'm anxious that I think there are far too many people in the West who haven't been listening, haven't been understanding the nature of this guy. Once again, the Chinese are watching. If Putin wins, then the Chinese will look at the West and see that we prefer comfort over victory. And therefore, I think that if we allow Putin to get away with what he's done in Ukraine, then the Chinese will try and gobble up Taiwan. So the world becomes a more dangerous place by appeasement, not a safer place. So my take is the best thing to do is to give the Ukrainians the heavy metal they need. That will cause the Russian army to be defeated. And then Russia looks at Putin and says, you're a loser. And they do to Putin what they did to Tsar Nicholas II. And the quicker they can do that, the better. Number two, Putin has surgery for whatever's wrong with him. And a doctor somehow makes it so he doesn't wake up. I would imagine if I'm the CIA, I'd be saying to all of the Kremlin's doctors, you can live in Beverly Hills forever. So that's number two. Number three, this is my favorite outcome, that actually he has been overdosing and abusing steroids, and he's got some kind of cancer, as Ashley thinks, of cancer of the lymphatic system, and that Putin may die because he's got cancer, because he's ended up poisoning himself. This is an ending befitting of Shakespeare.
Thank you for that, John. There's a question here.
From who's it from?
This is an anonymous question.
Okay, MI6, fuck off.
it's one I certainly hear quite a lot, which is, how do you respond to the idea that this isn't to do with Putin? This is simply kind of NATO expanding up to the border. You know, there is this consistent argument, isn't there, in the West, that NATO expansionism is, if not the kind of deterministic factor, then at least a key driver in this kind of, you know, strategic decision or calculus that Russia's made.
Who set the borders? I mean, where's our timeline start? So you could say that on September the 1st, or whenever it was, I've forgotten the date of the Nazi-Soviet pact, maybe it was August 30th or something like that. But actually, the borders were created by Adolf Hitler and Joseph Stalin. And these are the borders that Russian imperialists, Russian fascism, like. I mean, is that going to stand? I don't think so. I think nation states have a right to join a defensive military alliance, which is all that NATO is. NATO hasn't, I mean, leaving Iraq aside, NATO has not done. And then there's the question of Kosovo, but I think that's minor. And I was there and I saw the evidence of Milosevic's mass killings of the Kosovo Albanians. But essentially, I think it's perfectly fair for the Balts, the Lithuanians, the Estonians, and the Latvians to join NATO because they want to, because they didn't like what happened in 1939. If you go to Lithuania, Vilnius, there's a KGB museum, which is the old KGB headquarters in the main street in Vilnius. And it's one of the ghastliest museums I've ever been to. So I would invite your anonymous questioner to go into that thing and examine what Soviet imperialism, Soviet/Russian imperialism did to those places. And why they get it? Why are they so incredibly supportive of the Ukrainian struggle? Because they know what it's like. They know what it's like to fight. So I have no time for that question at all. The other thing is, you know, like I like speaking my mind. I'm sure the anonymous questioner does. You go to Russia, you switch that off. You hold your tongue. So whose side are you on? Are you on the side of democracy, free speech, and the rule of law? Or Vladimir Putin's killing machine? We need to make up our minds about this.
Well, let's go to Tom, now a named questioner. So Tom from Brighton.
He's the only person called Tom in Brighton, eh?
So Tom wants to bring you back, John, to the kind of networks of power in Russia now. And he says, you know, what about the oligarchs? You know, do they have any power left or are they just minding the money? I thought it was notable that you saw the kind of threat to come from the streets, you know, to come back to kind of organic, like political protest, really, rather than, say, the oligarchs kind of organizing.
No, I think the oligarchs, like Abramovich and Deripaska, and there are other sharks. I mean, these people are not, you know, you'd not want to introduce any of them to your mother and sort of say, oh, can I bring back Oleg Deripaska for tea? It's not that kind of person. So they have now seen Vladimir Putin pretty much destroy their life's work for the last 30 years. They can no longer park their yachts in Saint-Tropez, send their spawn to Eton or Winchester or even Harrow. They can't do that. And they're intensely angry with Vladimir Putin because his blinkered, unreal vision on the world has led to this catastrophe. It's a catastrophe for the world, for Ukraine, but also for Russia and for Vladimir Putin. So I think that actually the fourth case is that the oligarchs could try and get rid of him, and they've got a lot of money. So they hate what Putin's done, and that is another possibility. The Western intelligence agencies are mired in a kind of legal cat's cradle, where they're more like libraries. The James Bond is a fantasy. Even the Carrier is over the top. But the idea that MI6 or the CIA might actually do something against Putin, that's just silly. They collect information, but they don't do much these days. The oligarchs can and do. So I think it's possible an angry oligarch could get him knocked off. Fingers crossed.
Katie from Hammersmith. And this touches on an area we haven't actually spoken too much about, which is the kind of like tendrils of Russian influence into British politics and across Europe. What should we have done differently, Katie asks, after Salisbury? And I'll kind of add on to that. Why didn't we act differently? Why didn't we stand up to Putin then?
Well, so my view is that the MI6, the Foreign Office, Tony Blair, knew that September 1999 was a black flag operation. They knew that. They read the papers. They would have read my own piece in The Observer in March 2003 when I set out the evidence. And they looked the other way, and they wanted Putin to be Mr. Nice, and he wasn't. 2006, the poisoning with polonium 210. They waited like whatever it was, 8 years before there was a public inquiry. And that was after the shooting down of MH17. So 2014 is a big moment. They don't do the right thing then. Salisbury poisonings. I mean, come on, folks. Oh, okay, the Russian position is that two Russian sports nutritionists want to see the 123-meter tall Salisbury Cathedral. I actually, a friend of a friend, son's father is the dean of Salisbury Cathedral, and I managed to climb up Salisbury Cathedral. It took me about half a day because it's really, I've actually been inside the fucking spire. And like, while I was there, suddenly I was going on about, so the GRU, you know, silly, they never boing. And the video's up there online of the bells going, and boy, can you hear it? I felt, you know, never mind the Hunchback of Notre Dame. But what we did was we kicked out like 20 diplomats, and then Europe and the Americans kicked out another 100 or so. And Bill Browder says, so what? They just print another 120 passports. Doesn't matter. Immediately after that happens, Boris Johnson goes to a NATO meeting in Brussels. Then he flies. He ends up in Perugia, Perugia Airport, goes to the Lebedev's Palazzo Terranova. So the danger is the old man, Alexander Lebedev, who was a KGB spy in London from 88 to 92. The KGB is like Hotel California. You can check out, but you can never leave.
What is your... This is from James now, John. What's on your like kind of risk map in terms of ways out for Putin? Is it Trump being re-elected?
I can't see Trump being re-elected because I think he's too mired in filth probably DeSantis could make it, but DeSantis is good on Ukraine. I'm having less nightmares about Trump, which is sweet. So I think that the serious danger is that Western politicians are used to trading and dealing and compromising, and that's kind of in their DNA. And with dealing with Russian fascism, by the way, Putin didn't used to be quite as fascistic as he is now. So there's something around about the start of COVID where he goes into a darker place. So when I met him in 2014, he was subtle and sensitive enough to say, "Oh, here's an irritating prick from the BBC Panorama show. You know what I'm going to do is I'm going to treat him as if I'm a Democratic president." And
which he was very good at, it sounds like. He was very good at smothering the question.
Very, well done, president. Like, he gave a long and boring and fundamentally absolutely dishonest answer, but he gave me an answer, so I couldn't say he didn't answer me. And that guy has become more nationalistic. It may be because he thinks he's dying, in which case, by the way, he may be wrong about thinking he's dying, but if he thinks he's dying, then he's got to move quickly because he's run out of road. But I feel that the best way of ending this is to give the Ukrainians a heavy metal so that Putin's war has failed, and then the Russian people, the oligarchs, some of the secret policemen around him think, "This guy's useless, let's get rid of him." And the moment that sets in, then that's not good news. When a Russian leader loses a war, their longevity is limited.
Leonie from London gets the last question, which is about Iran. So of course, Putin's just jetted over there. Will Putin be able to get Iran on side? And what will be the impact if he does? And I guess a bit more broadly, will his famous kind of statecraft, you know, get him out of the mess that he's made for himself?
No. Iran is, I mean, they're just mucking around, I think. They're just being, the Americans don't like Putin, so we're friends. But essentially, if you're a clever Russian, you're an oligarch, you used to park your yacht in Saint-Tropez, you send your bastards to Eton, you park your money in the City of London, da, 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 da. And now you can fly all the way to Pyongyang. You can go to Eritrea, and you can go to Tehran. And by the way, the nightclub scene in Tehran is not what it used to be. So I think that this is a pathetic attempt by Putin to make his disasters look less bad. And I don't think it's going to work. And so I'm not very worried about that. I'm far more worried about the failure, or if people like Scholz persist in trying to pressure and weaken Ukrainians for a short-term and unlovely and unjust peace that gives Putin more time in power, he'll come back, there will be more war, and the Chinese are watching. So, I see this as 39-45. We've got to defeat these people because they're evil. Full stop.
Well, with that full stop is our full stop. So, everyone, thanks so much for coming. Thanks for all your brilliant questions. Thanks for being a brilliant audience. Thanks for not melting. Hopefully you haven't all melted. It's Killer in the Kremlin. I really cannot commend this enough. It's an absolutely wonderful book.
By the way, one other thing. It was horribly hot today, but it's horribly hot because we're spending far too much money on oil and gas. And the great threats to our society are Russian oil and gas and Saudi Arabian oil and gas and Iranian oil and gas. So if we can get off this addiction, it's better for the planet. I can wander around the streets of London without melting. And I'm not giving money to Vladimir Putin. So we've got, you know, for our own national security and the well-being of the planet, we've got to get off the Russian gas and oil habit. Sorry to interrupt.
Well, not at all. I can't think of a more powerful thought to end than walking around London and not melting, because that's really all I want to do. But John, thank you very much, both for the book, for today, and all the heroic reporting that you've been doing from Ukraine. So thank you.
Would you like to support Intelligence Squared in what we do? Well, just hit subscribe on Apple Podcasts and you can listen to Intelligence Squared ad-free, enjoy exclusive bonus content, and get weekly episodes in advance too. Hit subscribe and we'll see you on the other side.